So the title of my talk is From Raxacora Cephalopatorius with Love, Case Studies in Insider Threat. And for those who cannot read Circular Gallifreyan, I am Tess Schrodinger. So a little bit about me, or well, agenda first. Going to go over just kind of an introduction of myself, and then I can't see my slides. Little bit of history, some definitions. I'd like to get to some current research if possible, if I have time. Got to kind of cut this down and make it short so I can't be very funny. And then just for those who don't know, I won the art contest this year. So thanks for voting for me if you voted. Okay, so who am I? I've got about 20 years of law enforcement, investigation, industrial security experience. Forensics, I say bullets and blood, not ones and zeros, because back when I did forensics, if we encountered a computer, which was rare, we'd have to call the state and say, is there like a dude in a closet somewhere who knows what to do with this? Because it was a long time ago. I have a BA in sociology, a master's in security management, and I just completed my grad cert in cybersecurity technology. I've only been doing the cyber part for a couple years. My two mentors will attest to the fact that 4 years ago, the most complicated thing I could do was put my out of office on. And now I'm very proud to say that I can write snort rules. So I've come a long way. But today I want to kind of stay not technical for you guys. One of the things I noticed over the last couple years hearing people talk is the whole insider threat phenomena. They act kind of like it's this new thing. Like, oh no, suddenly we have to worry about this. And if you know your history, that's really not the case. Insider threat has been an issue since before the beginning of time, if you're counting at zero. Those are familiar with Judas Iscariot. Back in with Jesus, he's famous for selling him out for 30 pieces of silver to the Romans. And of course you have Guy Fawkes. Those who've seen V for Vendetta are probably familiar with the mask, but not a lot of people, at least the ones that I've run into that are kind of into the whole trendy thing with the mask, realize that it's taken from Guy Fawkes, which was actually the 1605 gunpowder plot to assassinate King James I of England. And they had packed the House of Lords with gunpowder in the basement, and they were just gonna blow it to high hell. And he was kind of caught guarding everything, so he's the guy who went down with it. And that's actually where that mask comes from. He kind of stands for the whole anti-establishment type thing. 480 BC, quite a long time ago, Battle of Thermopylae, anyone familiar with that? You had Ephialtes of Trachis, and he was the guy that pretty much sold his country out. The Greeks had set up position at this particular place because of how the cliffs were formed. It was kind of got them down into a narrow line. They were going to be a little bit easier to tackle as they were coming through single file. And Ephialtes decided that, you know, he'd make a little cash off this. He told the Persian army how to get around through the mountains to the south so that they could actually come up behind the Greeks' position. And, you know, we all know how that ended. His name is actually synonymous in Greece with traitor, still today. It's been a very long time, and they still use that word for traitor, just as in the U.S., if you were to call someone a Benedict Arnold, that is pretty much synonymous with traitor. We probably have a nice international crowd, so those not familiar with American history, Benedict Arnold was a Revolutionary War general, and he was an American Revolutionary War general, and very long story short, he got kind of bitter and frustrated with the politics and the things that were going on the American side during the Revolutionary War, so he decided to defect to the British side, and he was actually in command of West Point at the time, and the plan was he was going to just hand West Point over to the British when they came to get it. Major John Andre, who was a British soldier, was actually caught on a train. He had the plans to surrender West Point on him. So General Washington figured this out before it actually happened, sent some guys after Arnold. He managed to escape. He actually stayed in the country, fought on the British side, and led raids in Virginia and Connecticut before the end of the war. I believe he ended up going back to England after that. But he's, you know, one of our big traitors in history here. Does anyone know who Robert Ford is, not the Canadian current politician? Has anyone heard of Robert Ford? Robert? So, yes, I like Robert Ford because sometimes I'll hear people going, I ain't got to worry about insider threat, I am the threat. That's what Jesse James thought. Robert Ford and his buddy Dick Liddell were actually arrested by the sheriff way back in 1882. And they had actually shot and killed the cousin of Jesse James. And the sheriff had caught them, and Jesse James was a real pain in his ass at the time, and he wanted to get rid of him, but he was having trouble getting to him. So basically he made a deal with Robert Ford and said, hey, if you take James out, we'll make this go away. And Robert Ford, of course, says, sure, I can make that happen. So Robert Ford's brother, I think it was Charlie, actually worked with James and was on his gang and team and did jobs with him. So he told Charlie what was going on. You got to help me out, bro. Charlie goes back to Jesse and says, hey, my little brother wants to come hang with us and, you know, do some work. And James is like, sure, yeah, okay. And unfortunately, it did not end well. After breakfast in a boarding house one morning, when they went upstairs to pack to go hit the next job, Robert Ford put a hole in Jesse James's 10 ring. Game over. Took him out. Insider threat, right? And then finally, I can't imagine nobody knows the story of Julius Caesar and how he was betrayed by his friend Brutus. Those who are not familiar with the story, Caesar was a Roman general and politician who actually had risen up through the ranks pretty high, kind of gotten the point he was dictator for life. This didn't sit really well with a lot of the senators, because if you have a dictator for life, you really don't need a Senate. So they kind of were a little worried about their jobs, and in theory, they were worried about the democracy. I'm pretty sure they were more worried about their jobs. And they kind of got a conspiracy together to take Caesar out, and they tried to convince Brutus to join them, but Brutus was his friend, and he was a trusted confidant. He was a member of his inner circle. He had been made governor of Gaul by Caesar. You know, by all accounts, he was very, very tight and close to Caesar. But Caesar was being a pretty big douche, and so the conspirators finally convinced him to join them. And they staged a gladiatorial event, invited Caesar. He showed up. They surrounded him. The stabbing began. Historical accounts say that Caesar did try to fight back and crawl away. But once he saw that his friend Brutus was one of the people that had turned against him, he just gave up. Interesting trivia that I learned while I was doing my research, apparently the whole et tu, Brute, if you were forced to sit through Shakespeare in school, that is a Shakespearean invention. There's no actual evidence he ever said that. So win your next trivia game with that one, or Hacker Jeopardy. A couple current cases, more modern. This was Four Pillars Consulting versus Avery Dennison. Has anyone heard of this? If you do security awareness at your organization, this is a really fabulous example, and I love to use this one. I've used it for years. A lot of times people don't understand that there's a value to what they work with. To them, it's like, well, it's not a rocket. It's not like this top secret thing. Who cares, you know? They don't understand the value, and I love this example because Avery Dennison makes labels. They make the adhesive stuff that goes on diaper tape. Like, really? If I worked there, I'd probably be like, who the heck wants this? Well, apparently someone wanted it badly enough that they paid Dr. Ten Hung Lee between about $150,000 and $160,000 to get it. And he, over, I think, about a period of 8 years, siphoned this R&D and all these formulas and everything out to them. And he was, you know, eventually caught and everyone was charged. But I think this is a really good example because, you know, people are willing to pay that much money for that type of thing. Imagine what you work with and how much someone might be willing to pay for that. And this is, again, a great example to use with your staff when you're trying to show value to them, or at least maybe make them think a little differently about how valuable what they're working on is. Then we have Mr. Quentin Tarantino. Is anyone familiar with what happened earlier this year with him? Yes, he had a script that he wanted to do, and he showed it to six people. Six. And he said, don't show this to anyone. So, of course, it's on the internet like 2 days later. He was absolutely furious and just ballistic about this whole thing. He's got attorneys. He's demanding to know which one of these six people leaked it. And I believe last I heard, he'd shelved the script. He's like, I'm never making this movie. You've betrayed me. And he's still trying to figure out which of the people that he trusted betrayed him. And again, this isn't a high-tech or a DOD thing. This is a freaking movie script. But again, he was betrayed by someone he trusted. So a couple quick definitions of industrial espionage versus economic espionage. I like to give the difference because when you get further into the studies, it's just interesting to see how charges are done and things like that. Industrial espionage is essentially when two competitors go at each other, or two competitors or corporate adversary type things. In economic espionage is when you get into like foreign governments or nations, which could be through the guise of companies, and that's where the law gets all squirrely and people who make way more money than I do deal with that kind of stuff. As I was doing my research, I noticed that a lot of words were used kind of interchangeably. And I kind of was asking around, like, are there hard definitions for any of these? Pardon me, it's really dry. These are my definitions. Do not, like, if you use these on an exam and the teacher fails you, I take no responsibility. These are just my definitions, and I think they're pretty sound. A spy is going to be someone who doesn't necessarily require a pre-existing relationship with you. They could have one, but it's not necessarily required. A traitor, on the other hand, has to have that pre-existing relationship so that they can betray it. What's interesting about insider threat, which years ago when I started researching this I did not realize, is that an insider threat doesn't have to have a malicious agenda. So where your spy has an agenda to steal from you, or your traitor has an agenda to betray you, a malicious insider, or an insider can be malicious, meaning they have that agenda, or they can just be, you know, someone who's not, doesn't really care, they're apathetic, perhaps your security awareness program sucks, and they just don't know, or they're stupid. So they don't necessarily have to, like, maliciously have it out for your firm. They could just be, you know, a jackwagon, and that's your fault. No, I'm just kidding. So here's my obligatory sexy slide for DEF CON. I was told we had to have one in all of our decks. So honeypots, I know we use them a lot with networks, honey nets, things like that, but it's also an espionage term. Sharon Marie Scrannage. This one's for the ladies. And I say that because over the years when I've been briefed, countless times, what I found really interesting is that at some point, whether it's a man giving the brief or a woman giving the brief, inevitably there is a point where they say, okay guys, if you're not sexy at home in the bar down the street, you are not sexy 300 miles away from home at the conference, okay? So after a couple years of this, I finally asked one of the guys I work with, and I said, you know, I'm not sure if I should be incredibly flattered that you think that women, you know, we have our shit so much together, or we would, like, never fall for boys and their devil penis magic, you know, or should I be, like, insulted that you don't think we have anything of value to come after, or, like, maybe we're just not worth bothering to tell? And I kind of feel like that was the case with Sharon Scrannage. a little background, this occurred in Ghana in the 80s. And a little history. The only thing really important you need to remember from this slide is the name of the man in the coup. So Ghana essentially was part of the British Gold Coast. They broke free, decided to come to their own country. Inevitably, they were fighting about who got to be in charge, and you know how that always happens. this dude, Jerry John Rawlings, stepped up and said, I'm in charge, no more constitution, no political parties, that's the way it's going to be. His name's important, remember that as we go forward. So, Sharon Marie Scrantage was a CIA employee. About 7 years, she was an operations support assistant, so I think that's a fancy way to say secretary. By all accounts, she was a good girl. She wasn't a bad person. You know, she was honor student, high school cheerleader. She went to church religiously. She sang in the choir. She's a good girl, they say. So what happened to her? Well, a gentleman named Michael Sesudos happened to her, and he happens to be, this is where the other name comes in, the nephew of the man who ran the coup. So he was assigned to seduce Sharon when she was stationed in Ghana as the operations assistant to the station and get as much information as he could out of her. Now, the goal was to take that information, he passed it to the chief of intelligence for Ghana, Kojo Tsikada, and he in turn passed it along to the KGB, to Soviet bloc, Cuba, Libya, East Germany, pretty much anyone who wanted it, he shared. Why did he do this? Well, at the time, Ghana was pursuing a pretty capitalistic economic policy, but their foreign policy was pretty left-leaning, and they were really trying to cozy up to, like, Castro in Cuba and Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. So having this kind of information kind of helped them get in with some of the people they wanted to get in with. So how was she caught? She was caught when an inspection team came to the station, and she invited some folks over for dinner at her house, to be polite, and apparently one of them saw a photograph of Mr. Sesudos taped to her nightstand. I guess she had to pass her bedroom or something to get to the bathroom. And apparently in the photograph, he was not wearing any clothes, and he had his bed sheet draped strategically. It was a very sexy picture, and it was kind of pretty obvious what was going on. And he's like, look, Sharon, you need to stop this. Sharon's like, okay, I'll stop, which she didn't. So the inspection guy who had dinner there went back to the chief of station and told him what was going on. They were very concerned. They drew up a report. They sent it into what's called SAD, Special Activities Division with the CIA. I don't know if that's what it's called currently because this was back in the 80s, but they were basically the division that looked into agents' relationships with foreign nationals if they had them. So SAD looked into this and said, not really worried. A lot of our folks in foreign countries that are stationed there date foreign nationals regularly. We're not seeing any real big red flags, and by most accounts, no one felt that there was a real big concern at the time. They denied the request to bring her home and poly her immediately, and they said, you know, she's almost done there. She's on her way back. She's going to get reposted to Calcutta. We'll just do her poly when she's back on leave, and it'll be fine. Well, she goes in to do the poly. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with poly technique, but, you know, they basically ended up hitting a question that she really struggled with, and that was, you know, have you given classified information to anyone who's unauthorized? And that question really got her. After about 4 days of interview and interrogation, she pretty much just confessed it all. And she admitted she'd been giving all this classified information. I believe it included, like, names of folks that the United States thought were potential KGB double agents, plans for a coup against the current Ghanaian government by dissidents, comm data, stuff on military equipment that, like, Libya and other countries wanted from us. She was, like, sending all this out. And she was sending out a lot of the names of the people that were helping the CIA. She confessed all this. She ended up pleading guilty to 3 of 18 charges, mostly because she, you know, she felt bad, but she also agreed to help catch Sesudos. So he had come back over to the U.S. This actually happened in Springfield, Virginia. She got him to agree to meet her at a hotel, and they think the reason he did this was because they had planned to continue to use her as a source once she got to Calcutta, because as a whole new office, they'd have access to the data there. But they arrested him instead. He pleaded no contest to 2 counts of espionage. They sentenced him to 20 years in prison, but then they actually decided to let him go in exchange for all the Ghanaians that had been implicated when she released all that information to them. They'd all been rounded up and arrested, and they believe one person was actually killed for his involvement. So I believe a 94 U.S. News and World Report said it cost about $13 million to bring all those Ghanaians that were affected back over to the U.S. and resettle them and get them new lives. And that's, they exchanged him for that. Included among them were, like, there was a guy with the Post and Telegraph who had given the CIA the keys to the manhole covers so that they could get down in there and get into the cables and stuff. And there was a, the chief of police had been placing wiretaps in high up places. So those were some of the guys that they brought back over here. Let's see. So why? Well, supposedly she was married before she did her CIA career and went over to Ghana, and by all accounts, her husband had been pretty abusive and not very kind to her. And so she had just gotten out of a pretty bad marriage. And now you have to picture yourself, you're a black woman in the 1980s in a predominantly white male CIA station. I'm pretty sure they weren't inviting her to play tennis after work. So you've got this woman who's left a terrible relationship. She's very vulnerable. Now she's in a foreign country, thousands of miles from home and family and a support system, probably not with the most supportive working environment that could be given. And along comes this man who just is like, hey, baby, how you doing? And, you know, it's really easy to see how in her vulnerable position, she absolutely could have fallen for all of that. Now, she claims that in the beginning, you know, he basically just asked for the information, but then she was kind of hesitant, so he threatened to break up with her, so she went ahead and got it. But then once he had that spigot open, he stopped being nice. And he pretty much was threatening her with a gun, you know, threatening to kill her office workers or herself, and he was threatening violence. I think that was probably one of the reasons why she agreed to go ahead and help get him arrested. But I like to share that story because, you know, we talk about the guys all the time and the hot girls, but I think if you're a security person and you have anyone at your environment in a vulnerable position that could leave them open to compromise or being manipulated or being used like this, you need to be aware of that. And you need to be, you know, think of how you're going to handle that and how you can mitigate that problem as an organization to not only support a staff member, but, you know, to prevent damage to your organization at the same time. A little summary there. The big red flag one was that this was the fact that she promised to cut the relationship off and refused. The Intelligence Identities Act was a big player in this, and then this is also a huge one because the polygraph played such a key role in her confession and from them discovering this was actually going on. Because remember, they didn't really suspect her. It was the poly that caught it. This is another one. I'm going to do this one a little different. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this guy first, and, like, I'm assuming most of you are security professionals, but if you're not, just pretend you are. And I actually did this with my daughter. I'm like, tell me when something just doesn't sound right, okay? So you're at work one day, and you're at this big facility, and it's pretty sensitive stuff. It's not Target or, you know, 7-Eleven. You got some pretty sensitive stuff that a lot of people want to get at and have been trying to get at for years, and you're in charge of protecting it. And whoa, here we go. We've got a delegation of foreign scientists show up, unannounced for some meeting that's not been planned that you're aware of. Ding! Okay. Wait. Then one of your staff members saunters through the lobby and goes, oh, hey, how are you guys doing? Oh, you know, and he's like apparently really good friends with one of these scientists. Okay, you know, let me look at this a little closer. Call in the people that do the forensic testing, and they say, you know, did you know that this dude's been, like, you know, all that sensitive data you got on this network over here that's not supposed to leave this network over here? He's backing up copies to tape. Did you know this? Like, shit. Okay. So you go, you know what? Not going to jump to conclusions, not going to be a jerk about it, but I think you don't need to be on this project for a little while until we get this sorted out. So you take him off the project. Take his badge away. Take his access away. No more network for you, right? And so you're, like, trying to get this all sorted out, and you got him over here. You think you got him all. He goes behind your back over to another division to his buddy and goes, hey, dude, can I borrow your computer? And he goes and gets all the shit you took away from him, and he takes it again. Dinging yet? Red flag. And then Coincidentally, about 8 years ago, you find out that he was actually questioned by federal investigators because he was caught on a wiretap with another dude that just got busted for economic espionage. Spidey senses tingling yet? So who is this gentleman? Mr. Wenho Lee. Okay, so what he did was he worked for Los Alamos National Lab, and his job was to create simulations of nuclear explosions. They studied these simulations to improve the safety and reliability of the U.S. arsenal. So in March 99, he was actually fired from Los Alamos for failure to maintain classified information securely. So the same exact day, not sure how if they ever pinned down exactly who gave the information to the New York Times, but they ran this huge sensationalist story just all over the place. In December of 99, a federal grand jury actually indicted him for stealing U.S. nuclear arsenal secrets and giving them to the People's Republic of China. And then in September of 2000, a judge said, all right, but if this goes to trial, everything on the tapes needs to be disclosed. So Louis Free and Janet Reno went, shit. Oh. So they said, okay, we got to plea the guy out. So the whole deal with the plea out was, it was to keep the data from going public, obviously. And then they also, he had to tell them where the tapes that went that he backed up. And you know what he said? I destroyed them. It's cool. It's all good. He ended up pleading guilty to one felony count of illegal retention of national defense data. Then in 2006, he settled a $1.6 million lawsuit against the U.S. government and five different major media outlets for dragging his name through the mud before he was indicted. So the big question with him was he an insider threat? If you read his book, and if you listen to some government accounts, everyone was bending over backwards to apologize to this man for this unfair treatment and how, okay, we're sorry, but you're a security professional. What do you think? Take out the charges and the, what do you think? Was this guy a threat?
Yeah.
There you go. Good. Got the smart room. Okay. This next guy is my favorite dude. I love this guy. And I gotta tell you why I love this guy, all right? So you old school folks like me, you didn't always have like hard drives and USB things that you could put like a billion documents on and just stick it in your pocket and walk out, right? This guy was like total old school. Everything he stole was hard copy, okay? And I've seen pictures of his house. Wow. I mean, wow. This is Dong Fong Chong, or Greg Chung. He was actually caught. He was a Boeing stress analyst. He had a very high level clearance. He was caught during the investigation of another spy, Chi Mok. So Chi Mok, for those who aren't familiar with the gentleman, naturalized U.S. citizen, engineer with Power Paragon. That's a division of L3. He was found guilty in 2007 for conspiring to export sensitive defense technology to China. So what happened was while they're going through Chi Mok's house and going through all his stuff, they find these letters talking about this other guy. And, the handlers are basically like, hey, we know you don't have access to this. Can you see if Greg can get it for us? And they're like, who the fuck is Greg? So they finally figure out who Greg is, and they decide to do some surveillance on his house and take his garbage. Well, he thought he was being pretty clever because he was taking the documents, he was putting them in newspapers and putting them in his trash. So there were five searches of his trash between August and September of 2006. In every single one, they found design drawings, diagrams, technical data, project management data, engineering modification reports, stuff for the space shuttle. I mean, it's all in his garbage. Because I think he had kind of had a feeling they might be looking at him because his buddy Chi was in trouble. And so he's like trying to slide it in the trash one page at a time. So once they found all this, they're like, we need to take a closer look at this guy, which they did. So I'm going to tell you, as an investigator, the one thing I'd love if you could do, like Mr. Chung, is can you keep a journal of everything you do? because it makes it so much easier for me. You know, it's like you just write my report for me, and that's just such a headache. He kept a journal, literally documenting everything. There was really no way he could say, no, there was just no way. But the journal was really interesting because it gave a lot of insight into what he did and why he did it. A big part of it was the four modernizations project with China. Those aren't familiar with that. It was more back in the 70s. It was that China kind of is like, you know, we need this technology. We need to be competitive on the market. We need to be economically a superpower. And if we can't come up with the stuff or buy it, we're going to steal it. And that was basically, he wanted to help his homeland. So he actually, like, got a big bunch of stuff together and just sent it to a university guy in China. And he was like, fuck you, could you get us some more? And he's like, yeah, sure, got you covered. So eventually, 300,000 pages of documents were found in his house. Project 863 is kind of the newer version of the four modernizations. Google it if you want to know more. So this is a picture of the outside of his house. Like I said, I've seen video of the inside of this dude's house. They're like, there was not a surface area that wasn't covered with stacks of paper. And he had a crawl space that was like those big metal shelves, just freaking stacked. I was like, holy crap, how did he get all that out? I mean, it's just amazing. You just got to respect the guy for being able to, you know, he didn't have a little stick. He took the shit, right? I was like, damn, wow. Apparently, I heard someone say that at one point when they looked at it all, they figured he had the largest repository of space shuttle data in the world in his basement, right? I was like, god damn. So one of the things they found in his house during the search was a tasking list, because when he started giving them the stuff, they're like, could you please get us this? They literally gave him like a grocery list of what they wanted, and he'd go get it and bring it back. So this is just an example of the kind of stuff he was handing over to him. And then there was another tasking list. This is the one that went when they were in Chimak's home, because what they were doing was they were going through Chimak because he didn't have access to all the same stuff that Greg had. So they were kind of like, whatever he couldn't do, he's kind of subcontracting out to him. So this is the guy. This poor man. I actually use this with my daughter as why she needs to learn how to spell. Because I'm like, you don't want to get a crappy nickname from the NSA if you jack things up. He literally was known as the spy who couldn't spell. I'm not kidding you. I just started laughing the first time I read that. Brian Patrick Regan, not the comedian. Former Air Force Master Sergeant. Father of four, he was actually trained in cryptoanalysis by the United States Air Force. This occurred like 99 into 2000s. From 95 to 2000, he was assigned to NRO in Chantilly, Virginia. He was a signals intelligence specialist. And in 99, he was nearing the end of his 20-year service limit for his rank. And he was really worried about money because he was $117,000 in debt. And he had four kids to send to college. So he did what all of us would do. He wrote a letter to Saddam Hussein. And he said, hey, Saddam, I got some shit you might want. I'll give it to you for $13 million. But, you know, he done with his buddy, he'll write back. So he also sent letters to Libya and Cuba and China. So we had a foreign source somewhere on one of those ends who saw this letter and came back to us and said, hey guys, you got somebody trying to, you know, get rid of your shit there. You might want to check on this. But they couldn't figure out it was. All they had was that the letters were full of like horrible misspellings. Like instead of espionage, it was esponage. It was just really bad. So literally when they were trying to find this guy, they were looking for the bad speller. For those who had to read Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck, some accounts compare him to Lenny. No, literally, they really did call him, like, there were people that said he's kind of like Lenny. He was a pretty bright guy, but he really had trouble communicating, and he said he always felt stupid, and he really struggled with reading and writing because he was dyslexic. So in 2001, the FBI arrested him at Dulles Airport on board a plane getting ready to go to Zurich. He'd actually told his boss he was taking the wife and kids to Disneyland. He lied. So when they arrested him, this is what he had on him. I really can't see my stuff. He had stuff in his pockets. He had classified papers. He had spiral notebooks full of things and cards. And they could not make heads or tails of this. This is the other funny part, is apparently NSA couldn't break any of his stuff. Now, to their credit, 911 had just happened. They had some other stuff on their plate. This dude wasn't like high on their list of priorities, so this actually kind of landed in the lap of a FBI crypto analyst named Daniel Olson, who managed to crack all this. So, you know, kudos to him. It's a good job. So what was interesting was that Olson kind of was looking at dyslexic stuff, and he kind of figured out there was this technique that some of them use where they use pictures or words instead of numbers to help things from getting transposed in their mind. So he looked at these words, hand, tree, hand, car. And so he like kind of thought about them. And then he said, you know what? Five fingers, one tree, five fingers, four wheels on a car. Since it was found near his Ameritrade account number in his wallet, he gave it a try, and it worked. It was the PIN code for his Ameritrade account. We got it. So then they took this theory, and they kind of applied it to all the other stuff they found that was in this category of, you know, the words, because there was like a long list of words. And they actually figured out that they, we don't have all the full site number, but the first three digits were Chinese missile sites. And so they actually were able to go, okay, now we know what he's doing here. So the next, in his wallet there was a paper with a string of numbers. That turned out to be a Caesar cipher, and apparently he was really inspired by the movie Manhunter with Hannibal Lecter and the Tooth Fairy serial killer guy. So he used the book code to do this Caesar cipher thing, and it turned out to be addresses of Swiss banks so that he could, you know, put all the money his buddy Saddam was going to give him, you know, over there in Switzerland. And then there were these pages of trinomes, right? And it took them a long time to figure this one out because they couldn't get the key to that cipher, right? So finally, because he's, you know, trying to be a helpful guy, he ends up telling them that the ones, there were 19 caches. These were all ended up to be longitude GPS coordinates for the caches where he buried the data. And originally he'd stolen the stuff and hid it in a locker, but then he put it in garbage bags and then dug holes in the ground and put it in there. And you know, in case you're wondering, holes in the ground in a garbage bag are not authorized storage methods for classified material. Trust me on that one. So there were 19 caches total, 12 in Virginia, Pocahontas State Park, and 7 in Maryland, Patapsco Valley State Park. And apparently he used the NRO phone list for the Virginia ones and his junior high school yearbook for the ones in Maryland. But then he told the guys they could also drive north on 95, exit 12A, walk up the ramp, dig up the toothbrush container he buried by the fence, and it had everything in plain text because he was a little worried he might lose his papers or forget. So he wanted a backup, which was buried in a toothbrush container on an exit ramp on 95. So in Virginia, he happened in that park. He buried, they went out and found, I think he was messing with them. He just kind of like went out behind the trees and they found the ones because he marked them with roofing nails. And they dug all these holes and couldn't find it. And they go back to him and he goes, oh yeah, I dug on the opposite side of the tree of the nails. Okay, they found it. So then they went to Maryland and tried to do the same thing. And they couldn't find it there, even on the other side. And he goes, well, no, the trees with the nails there, I put the tree across from it. Yes. But basically, you know, he's all into the whole crypto thing, and he used it. But what the funny part I thought was is that he made it so complicated that he actually ended up forgetting a lot of it, and he had to like re-crack his own code with Daniel Olson. They had to like work on it together. So learn how to spell, kids. Get a good nickname. So some current research, I'm glad I have time to get to this. This first one actually is really relevant, especially with what just happened to the general in Afghanistan. I ran across this article and I included a link to it. I honestly am not super up on the technology. It was just, I thought it was really neat to put a technical thing on, now on this kind of non-technical problem. What?
That's my author.
Are you him?
Yeah.
Dude, that was awesome.
Thank you.
So if you have questions about this, the dude is right here. So in a nutshell, helmet, blood flow, tests, algorithm, they say, you know.
So.
Come on! I planned this.
Sorry. Yeah, that totally makes more sense, right? Yeah, that, oh, well, look at that. That's crazy. This is like really modern shit. Okay, so the guy, he was a counterintelligence agent. His name was Daryl Smell. And what he figured out was that if you are looking at an image that has you have some emotional attachment to, then you send off this really big signal out of a portion of your brain. And so what they did was first they put this helmet on you, and it's an fMRI helmet, and it also, no, it's an MRI. And so what they're doing is it's they're looking at the electromagnetic activity that comes out of your brain, and they were going to take a bunch of Iraqi troops and also Afghan troops, put this helmet on them, and first, you know, establish a baseline, and then start showing them pictures that if they were a potential insider threat, they would have an emotional attachment towards, like the picture of a particular person that they may have come in contact with, a picture of a particular place that only an insider threat would possibly know. And so this way, because your brain sends out the signal far too fast for you to attempt to hide it or obfuscate it, then using the data that they were getting from this helmet, they would know if you were lying far more effectively than if you have to like explicitly lie. But moreover, you didn't have to actually say anything. You didn't have to go ahead and do the whole lie. Your brain was actually indicating your familiarity emotionally with a picture or with a subject that was a telltale sign of your insider threat dumb. And so what they're trying to do right now is sell this actually in Afghanistan and Iraq to the US military so that they can stick them on troops that are with the Afghan or the Iraqi military that we're working with to pre-detect potential insider threats.
Thank you. There's a link to his article at the bottom of the slide, so you can probably link on that and get his contact information or, you know, mob him after this. I'm sure he doesn't mind. This one's really neat. This is plagiarism algorithm detection. So I'm so old that when I wrote my papers at first college the first time, I did them in longhand, right? You got extra credit if you typed your paper. So what this is really neat is I just recently finished master's graduate work, and everything I did, I had to do this turn it in thing. Has anyone done this? Yeah, so this is kind of cool. It takes your paper and it runs it past like everything on the planet apparently, and in 2 seconds it can shoot you out this report, and it kind of gives you a familiarity thing. So like you have to turn the report in with your paper to your professor to show that you haven't basically copied the whole thing and plagiarized it. Really kind of neat, I thought. But what some guys figured out to do is you could use the same theory, and only instead of running it past the entire internet like it's a term paper, you're going to look at emails leaving your facilities or your sites or your organization because, you know, it's, you know, maybe, you know, Greg Chung can get 300,000 pages out, but, you know, people may be more hesitant now. They're like, I can just email it to my house, right? And nobody will catch me going out the back door with it. So what this does is it takes all the emails, puts them through a filter, and it does like the same type of algorithm. You can set a threshold for your intellectual property to look at every single email. And if anything hits a certain threshold where you're like, well, wait a minute, we don't need all that leaving, you can either set it to like alert, but let it go, just so you know and you can look into it. Or if there's like a lot, a certain other threshold, it can go, whoa, no, that's not going anywhere. And it'll still alert you, but you can actually stop the email before it even leaves. So this was really interesting. And again, I have a whole sources section at the end where I've cited like to hell and back. I just finished graduate work, so everything's cited. And there's this whole paper is listed and cited with authors if you're interested. And then the last one, a couple years ago, this gentleman presented a Black Hat on stochastic forensics. Is anyone familiar with that? No, this is so cool if you're into math. So he's looking from a forensic perspective at your computer usage. So if you sit down and use your computer every day, there's kind of a baseline for how you act and what you do. And if you're copying like large masses of things or trying to exfiltrate them, that changes your pattern. Because suddenly it's not your normal baseline anymore. You're doing something kind of hinky. And so they can actually go back and look at this and maybe not necessarily use it for evidence, but it could be an indicator of something you might need to look at closer. It's a very technical paper, and I can just write snort rules now. I'm not quite to this other level yet, but it's very interesting. If you can read at that level, check it out. And there's some interviews with him and some articles, so point you in that direction. Are we good on time? Or
2 minutes.
Okay, really fast. Mitigation, funny cartoon my guy gave me, but it's really sad at the same time because it's true. Communication and awareness, oh my gosh, that's a whole other presentation. We'll do that next year. These are some of the organizational factors they found that are really the biggest contributors to whether or not you have more potential threat. The ease of which people can get stuff out of your organization, how you handle disciplinary things, you know, do you actually have consequences for bad behavior, or do you just kind of ignore it or blow it off? And then what can we do? The big thing is support your security people. Support the job they're trying to do, not just with attaboys, but money if they need it. Yes, all the money. And, you know, you need to work with your people. They're not like tokens on a chessboard, they're people. You need to understand them, and you need to understand what makes them tick, and then you need to understand how that could affect your organization if they start ticking wrong. So I think I'm out of time. What do you do? Call someone trusted, your general counsel, your legal department, your, what do they call it? JAG? What do the government people call it? The hotlines, whatever those numbers are. And then sources. On this slide, you should have all this. I give you pretty much everything I researched. So, anyway, thank you.